And we're back on Dealing Together, where we help good people who fell for bad deals. First caller?
I had to buy 3 identical sweaters to get the 4th free.
Ooh, you got fleeced. Next caller, what's your deal?
I paid for 20 tanning sessions, but had to use them in a month. Now I'm orange.
Ooh, you got burned. Next caller.
I traded in my old Samsung at AT&T for a new Samsung Galaxy S24 Plus.
How's that bad?
I got to choose from their best plans.
So, what went wrong?
Oh, nothing went wrong.
And you're calling to...
to request a song?
You want a song. Of course.
The choice is yours.
Our best smartphone deals. Your choice of plan. Learn how to get the new Samsung Galaxy S24 Plus with Galaxy AI on us with eligible trade-in. AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Offers vary by device, subject to change. S24 plus 256GB offer available for a limited time. Terms and restrictions apply. See att.com/Samsung for details.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast on the business of entertainment. I'm Jem Aswad, Deputy Music Editor. Now, the entertainment world is filled with people who can do a lot of stuff. But even by that standard, Evan Bogart is a rarity. He's a songwriter of hits for people like Beyoncé, Rihanna, Lizzo, Madonna, Demi Lovato, and lots of others. He's the owner of a large publishing company called Seeker Music that just bought the catalog of 80s superstar Christopher Cross, as well as several other songwriters. He's chair of the Recording Academy's new Songwriters and Composers Wing. And not least, he's the son of the late legendary Neil Bogart, the founder of the 1970s powerhouse Casablanca Records, which brought the world Kiss, Donna Summer, Parliament Funkadelic, The Village People, and lots of others. Neil is the subject of Spinning Gold, a biopic directed and written by Evan's older brother Tim, and for which Evan is executive music producer. It comes out on March 31st. Evan talks about all of the above and lots more after the break.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. LifeLock monitors and alerts you to identity threats you may miss on your own, even if you're careful with your personal information. And if you do become the victim of tax-related identity fraud, LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists ready to help solve identity theft issues on your behalf. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Why wait for your tax refund in vain? Help protect your information immediately with LifeLock. Go to LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 25% your first year. That's 25% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Identity theft protection starts here.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
We are here with a stunning view of the 405 freeway in Los Angeles with Evan Bogart, and I'm going to have to take a couple of breaths when I'm describing all of the things that he does, because he is a songwriter of a song you may have heard, Halo, by someone named Beyonce, as well as songs by Lizzo, Madonna, Jason Derulo, Demi Lovato, many others, a publisher, CEO of a company called Seeker Music. He is chair of the Grammy's new Songwriters and Composers Wing, which is to obviously represent songwriters and composers in the Recording Academy. Not least, he is son of the legendary Neil Bogart, founder of Casablanca Records, which brought the world Kiss, Donna Summer, The Village People, Parliament Funkadelic, and many, many others. He is also a husband, a father, a bon vivant, a triathlonist. All right, I made that part up. Welcome, Evan Bogart.
I wish I was a triathlonist. It depends what the triathlon is of.
Careers.
Like, yeah, careers. Definitely a triathlon. I'm like a Tough Mudder finalist if it comes to careers, I guess.
Even still. So I will just lead by asking you, how do you do all those things? Do you have a very structured date book? Do you have a multi-compartmentalized mind? I mean, how?
I definitely have a multi-compartmentalized, that's hard to say. I definitely have a multi-compartmentalized mind, but I guess lots of routine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way to say it. Like, I have a routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I stick to my routine, I'm able to get it all done and maintain my sanity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a believer in the phrase that, like, through structure comes freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when I'm not structured, I feel like I'm bouncing all over the place. I'm pulled in so many different directions and nothing's getting done. Mm-hmm. I structure my day into hour blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And within those hour blocks, I'm able to slot different things in, depending on what the priorities of that week are. And that includes, like, wellness.
Uh-huh.
That includes exercising, includes spending time with my family, includes taking some time off. Like, I schedule all of that.
When did you start writing songs?
In 2005, I got sober. I felt really creative, and I decided I was going to put together a girl group. And I was auditioning girls. I picked three. Mm-hmm. I put them together. I was getting tracks from my two best friends at the time, an unknown up-and-coming producer at the time named J.R. Rodham,
mm-hmm.
and an unknown up-and-coming producer, lead singer of an unknown band named Ryan Tedder.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
People are now major producers.
Well, I would say a year and a half later, I tried to make that album, it would have cost me $2 million. So I was getting tracks from them And about 40 songs in, Zach sat me down, Zach Katz, and said, you know, these songs are good. Mm-hmm. The girls are good, but they're not hits.
Mm-hmm.
You can't shop this group unless you have hits. And I'm like, well, what do I do? And he's like, why don't you try writing the songs? And I was like, me? Pop mm-hmm. songs? And he's like, yeah. Like, you're so creative. Like, give it a shot. Like, you have all of JR's beats. Just sit down and try writing to them. So I wrote this one song. That was called Jungleistic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Terrible title. Whatever. But they were like, whoa, that's really good. Like, write another one. So I wrote the second song called Rescue Me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, that sounds like a smash. Like, let's go shop the group. But yeah, I mean, we shopped the group. No one wanted to sign them. Everybody wanted to buy the songs, though. They were like, yeah, we already have girl groups or we have an artist. These songs will work great for this artist. And eventually Jay Brown, when he was running Island Def Jam with Jay-Z, mm-hmm. said, you know, sell me these songs. And they basically called me when they were like, good news, bad news. I'm like, what? And they're like, you got to let the girl group go. I'm like, what? They're like, yeah, man, everybody's passed. Like, it's not going to happen. And I'm like, this is like my big like comeback in sobriety. And I'm like, feel so creative. Like, how could you tell me that? And they're like, well, they're buying Rescue Me. Island Def Jam's buying it. Christina Milian's going to cut it. And I was like, oh, well, all right. I mean, mm-hmm. that sounds pretty cool. And so, unfortunately, I let the girl group go. Mm-hmm. And we sold the song. And then a month later, I found out that Christina Milian didn't want to cut it because she thought it was too pop. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, that just ruined everything. So now I let the girl group go. Island Def Jam owns my song. They're not using it. And then Jay Brown was like, no, we have this new girl that we signed. Just let us cut her on it. Her name's Rihanna. Mm-hmm. And
it went on her first album.
Her second album. Her first album was the one that had Ponda Replay on it.
Right. Okay.
And he basically was like, she had like a mid-charting, like mid kind of club hit, Ponda Replay. Like, we really think she's going to be a star, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And she was 17 at the time and she cut it. And then he was like, he's like, check it out. Here's SOS. And I'm like, no, Rescue Me. He's like, no, SOS. And I was like, he's like, yeah, that's the title. Which is interesting, right? So he changed uh-huh. the title to SOS and then parentheses, Rescue Me. Uh-huh. So stupid. Should have just been SOS. But whatever.
It worked.
It totally worked. Right. Mm-hmm. So then 6 months later, the song comes out and it blows up. Mm-hmm. And I remember going February that year in 2006, I remember going to, they used to throw at House of Blues, rest in peace, House of Blues. They used to throw these American Express Platinum Grammy Week parties right. events. And every week they would have every night they'd have a different artist playing. One night they had Fall Out Boy playing. So mm-hmm. this was when Jay-Z was running it. And so I went there and Jay Brown brought me over to Jay-Z, who Jay-Z whispered in my ear, SOS, effing smash, dude. Mm-hmm. F smash. And I was like, whoa, Jay-Z just told me my song's a smash. And then in May, it was.
So the moral here is if you want to be a songwriter, try to do something else.
Kind of. I mean, honestly, I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the excitement of having a number one song, your first cut, and the dread that comes along with, I hope I can do it again because I don't want them to figure out I'm a fraud. You know, mm-hmm. that kind of like...
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Right? Like that comes along with it. Like I didn't toil at songwriting for you. I didn't arrive on a bus in Nashville with a guitar on my back. And like, I wasn't sitting there like trying to get in rooms and all of a sudden I was just like, I wrote, you know, a number one song for, you know, weeks. I think it was like number one for 3 weeks. And like everyone was trying to get in with me, but I was working at the agency. Mm-hmm. And so JR and Zach would call me every day and be like, you got to leave the agency. And I'm like, I can't, you know, mm-hmm. like I'm sober. I have a job. Like I have an expense account and insurance and like my mom will kill me, you know, and like my mom's having calling her friends in the music industry, like Barbara Kane, and all these people are calling mm-hmm. me. They're like, don't leave. Like, uh-huh. you know, you never know if you're going to have another hit. And like,
so what was the next hit?
Well, so eventually they were like, what's it going to take for you to leave the agency? And mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know. Put me in the studio with Britney Spears. And the next week, me and JR spent a week in Vegas working with Britney on Blackout. Uh-huh.
What was that like?
I mean, that was wild uh-huh. because K-Fed was there. This is that era, right? So K-Fed's in one studio, Britney's in another. JR's, you know, playing beats for K-Fed and cutting Britney in the other room at the same time. It was kind of... It was wild. It was mm-hmm. It was an era. I mean, mm-hmm. Britney Blackout era was, I mean, it got even wilder. And I was there for a lot. I was there for a lot of it because JR and her started dating and it was like a whole thing. JR was like her rebound after K-Fed. So like that was like that was definitely an interesting time.
Well, wasn't a lot of Blackout produced by Danger?
Yeah, it ended up.
Uh-huh. Ended up.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Another lesson, which is you should... maybe date the artist that you're working with. I don't know.
Okay.
We'll be right back with Strictly Business.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Celebrate the end of your workday with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as another busy Tuesday flies by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome back to Strictly Business with Evan Bogard. How did you and Ryan Tedder end up writing Halo for Beyonce?
Ryan was on tour with One Republic, and I think they're in Michigan. And he ruptured his Achilles playing basketball on an off day.
Nice.
And they had to cancel the rest of the tour, and they flew back to LA. And on his first day back in LA, I went over to his apartment. And the minute his wife, Genevieve, left to go to work that day, Ryan got up on his crutches and was like, let's go write a song. And I'm like, you're supposed to like play it easy, man. And he's like, no, let's go write. And so we went into his second bedroom where he had a studio, and he was like, Jay Brown's looking for a love song for Beyonce. And I was like, well, what should we write about? And at the time, we were really big fans of this song called Shelter by Ray LaMontagne. It was like when Ray's first album was out.
Yeah.
And I was obsessed with that album, Trouble and Shelter and all those songs, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, what if we had a song like Shelter? Like, what would like Beyonce and Jay-Z, like, they were like the worst kept secret in the world, right? Like, everyone knew they were together, but they weren't out in public about they were together. So we were like, what would people that were that big want from each other, like to know that they could keep each other safe in a way that no one else could keep them safe, you know? And I was like, kind of like Shelter, like you will shelter me and I will shelter you, you know, like that kind of thing, like be each other's shelter. I was going down my list of song titles that I had, 'cause I always keep like tons of song titles, tons of voice notes, tons of lyrics. And I had this list of song titles, and literally as my finger hit the word Halo in my song titles, Ryan played this patch on his keyboard, which was this angelic patch that's in the song. And we kind of looked at each other and we were like, yeah. And 3 hours later, it was written. Ryan sent it to Jay Brown. An hour later, Jay Brown wrote back, that's hot, hold it for Beyonce. And then, by the way, no bridge. There was no bridge in the song at the time. So the next day, now that we knew that they wanted it for Beyonce, Ryan and I decided we need to write a bridge. So we came in and we spent 3 hours writing a bridge. Just a bridge, as long as it took us to write the whole rest of the song, because now we're overthinking it, right? We're like, how do we write a Beyonce bridge? Like Ryan's vocal acrobats, and he's like singing, it's all wordy. And so when she goes to cut the song, of course, she ditches the bridge and just does the opera part.
To me, it's an irony and an unbelievable travesty that the songwriter is basically at the bottom of the totem pole in the music industry today, in terms of power, in terms of earning. It makes absolutely no sense to me. Now, you are not just a self-publisher anymore. You are the CEO of a publishing company. Are these things that you look to address with Seeker Music, your company? And I mean, your elevator pitch includes something about it's this company is run by creators.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have my kind of own, like, I call them Seeker's family values. And they're basically a list of things that our culture, you know, is driven by at Seeker. A lot of that has to do with, as a songwriter myself, these are the things that I would never want done to me.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way I want to be serviced. This is the way I want to be supported. This is the way that I, this is the kind of team that I want to have. This is the kind of strategy I want to have around what I do. This is the kind of way I want to be nurtured and thought about. And so, you know, you have a songwriter kind of creating this culture for songwriters and for songs, because we also acquire songs, and celebrating them and supporting them in a way that I would want my own catalog and my own songwriter self supported and celebrated. And so some of that is like, I would never offer a deal I wouldn't sign myself. Like, simple as that, right?
Who are some of the songwriters you're representing, and can you attach just some of the hits they might be known for the people who don't know?
Well, we just start, I mean, as far as on the acquisition side of things, yeah, I mean, we've recently bought, or invested into John Bellion's catalog, who's just a genius, and John Ryan, equally a genius.
Who have they written hits for?
I mean, Eminem, Maroon 5, One Direction, you know, a couple up and coming artists like that.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And obviously John Bellion's an artist himself, and John Ryan's, you know, featured on a few things too, like Pitbull Fireball and whatnot. But more than that, you know, we did deals with Mozella, who wrote Wrecking Ball. We did Sam Waters, who was in Color Me Bad, and then ended up writing a bunch of hits for Natasha Bedingfield and Jordan Sparks and Anastasia. We did Christopher Cross. We bought both his publishing and his masters. And
timeless.
I'm a massive Christopher Cross fan, which is as a songwriter. I mean, people don't realize
that shows in your hip hop background.
Yeah,
clearly.
Of course. Yeah. No, but people don't realize. I like. First of all, the theme from Arthur is like, I mean, I can't listen to it without getting chills and almost like welling up in my eyes. It's just such a beautifully written song, you know? And obviously I grew up in like a household of my parents were friends with like Carol and Bert, and like, you know, that's how I knew who Christopher Cross was originally, right?
That would be that. Carol King and
Carol Bayer Sager.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess like Carol could have been Carol King. Good point. Mostly would be Carol King.
Yes, but they were married.
But like Chris, like people don't realize about Chris. In 1980, he was the biggest artist in the world. And I say that because there are three artists ever in the history of the Grammys who have won in 1 year, Album of the Year, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best New Artist, all in the same year. And those three artists, the first one was Christopher Cross.
It's amazing. And nobody knew what he looked like. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The second one was Adele. And the third one was Billie Eilish.
Yep.
So if you think about how big those people were at the time that they achieved that, and you apply that to 1980, you're like, wow, Christopher Cross was huge.
All right, that's pretty damn cool.
And I didn't know that till later on in my life.
Okay. One thing I noticed about you and your older brother, Tim, who you guys have all been working on, Spinning Gold, a biopic about Neil Bogart and Casablanca Records.
Yeah.
You guys both have this unusual ability to be strong in both business and creative. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it. You don't usually creatives don't usually make the best business people and vice versa. I mean, is that just come naturally to you? You can shift lanes like that. It can go from one to the other. Is it just part of that compartmentalized brain?
It's pretty weird, actually. Yeah. I could be in a session and I need to take a business phone call. Switch the light, take a business phone call, come back into the session, switch the light, go back into being creative.
Wow.
And I've seen my brother do it on set as well. Like literally be directing a movie and then be on the phone at a marketing call and architecting strategy for rolling out Spinning Gold and then come back to directing, right? Like it's, I don't know. I don't know if it's genetic, because it's not like him and I went to a school together for that or like ever even talked about it. We just do it. But you know, deeper than that, I've tried to only be creative and I miss the business side. I'm like, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do this. And I've tried to just stop being creative and just focus on building my businesses. And I feel like my soul's missing. They kind of feed each other. and they're like symbiotic for mm-hmm. me. Like mm-hmm. I can't do one without the other. I need to be able to activate both sides of my brain at any given time.
Now, do you think that comes possibly from your dad, which sort of dovetails into a spinning gold conversation,
right?
Because like, he was a musician first.
No
right?
one taught me that. It mm-hmm. has to.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And again, my brother and I never have talked about it. It has to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to explain it. Well, it's got to be genetic in some way, right? It's got to be weirdly genetic.
Well, let's talk about the film for a minute, because I know your dad passed when you were very young. You know, Tim was a bit older. So on the one hand, your experience with your father is so much based on secondhand stories and legend and things like that. But also, it's really funny. The film, which was 23, 25 years in the making, Tim Bogart decided when they were very far along to stop working with the person who was the lead, who was playing Neil Bogart, and go with someone else. And it was very much a go-for-broke gut decision, very much in the spirit of Neil Bogart, because that's the kind of company that Casablanca Records was. Knife edge, risk, go-for-broke, and he pulled it off more often than not. And when I was talking about that with Jeremy Jordan, who's the lead, I was saying to him, you know, isn't that funny? You know, the decision to bring you in was very much a kind of Neil Bogart move. And he said, there's so little video of Neil Bogart speaking that I would really just look at Tim and take from him to channel the character. And I see a lot of similarities between the two of you. What has the experience of making that film been like for you?
I mean, it's been, well, first of all, because I was four when my dad passed away, I've learned so much about my dad through the experience of research and making this film over the last couple decades, all the different interviews and stories and people who have, you know, gone on record about their relationships and sitting down with artists and sitting down with executives from back in the day and hearing what they had to say about my dad. It's like I've kind of formed who he was. You know, my mom obviously is still around and she's spoken to me a lot about him as well, but it's also just really hard to kind of put my finger on what, I don't know, it's weird. Like I just never had a relationship with him. He had a relationship with me, but I never had a relationship with him. So I think a little bit of this movie movie making experience was feeling closer to him in some way. But it was also a cathartic experience, you know, in the sense that it was a little bit of like processing. I've never really processed his death. I've never really dealt with it in the way that I probably should have. Cause I never really grew up close to him. He was, like you said, a myth, a legend, a story. You know?
But how would you process that anyway when you're 5 years old? And
no, but I mean, I don't know. I don't even know. I honestly don't know. I don't know how I'm supposed to process that. I will say this, like, I can't make it through the movie. I've seen it at least 50 times, maybe more. I can't make it through the movie without, I mean, you've seen it.
Yeah.
I can't make it through the movie without crying in the last monologue at the end. Every time. I've like pinched myself, bit my cheek, looked away, closed my ears. I can't make it. I mean, I get emotional even talking about it. It's like, and when I read the script the first time, I couldn't make it to the script without crying. And so there's definitely something that's like, I feel connected to it in that way, you know? I obviously had an amazing upbringing. It's not like I didn't want for anything. You know, it wasn't something where I was like, I felt like I lost out on something, but I did. I feel like through the process, I've gotten to know my father in a way that I never would have been if we never made the movie.
The ending that Evan is referencing, the Neil character is looking back, he's talking about his career, and Kiss, Parliament, Funkadelic, The Village People, Donna Summer, Disco, all these things that he didn't create, but midwifed. And he's sort of saying that. He says, none of you knows my fucking name.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is it, not only is that true, but like it's also very touching in that the film ameliorates that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and honest, like most people don't know who Neil Bogart is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always likened it to the same way. Like I didn't know who Henry Hill was before I saw Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I always joke like the movie should have started as far back as I can remember. I always wanted to be a record man, you know, like because to me it has that Goodfellas vibe, but in the music sense, you know, not like it's mafia, but just in the sense that it's like
it's a little mafia.
No, there's a little bit in there, but it's not like full mafia. Right, I mean, by the way, could have totally gone that way, right? I mean, that was the era, right? Yeah. But I think Tim tastefully had that in there in a way that wasn't overly that way. But either way, I think it's a real, this isn't, you know, a lot of people are like, it's a Casablanca movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It is, but it's not really the Casablanca movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the Kiss movie, and it's not the Donna movie, and it's not the Parliament movie or the Village People movie or even all the artists that were on Buddha. Mm-hmm. Before Casablanca, or you know, Bill Withers and Gladys and all the other stuff. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's the Neil Bogart movie, and I think it is an amazing homage to the spirit and the passion that he had for music and musicians and for artists,
mm-hmm.
and for being like the real greatest showman, mm-hmm. you know, and really fighting for what he believes in and for dreaming. And I think that spirit was captured mm-hmm. on film. I really do. I also think that, you know, there are other sentiments that were also captured on film. Like, you know, there's that whole scene where they talk about, is it, you know, would be great to like, have everything and die young or die old. And I think that like there's a little bit of like, you know, of his own demons that are captured on film too. It's not just a fluff piece. Like it's not
more
just
than
that
a little.
Right? Yeah. No, I'm just, you know, right. And I'm just saying like it's honest. It's really honest.
Yeah.
So while it captures the spirit and love and passion and belief and the dreamer that was Neil Bogart, it also captures the human that was Neil Bogart.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's also very interesting in that I had met you before I had seen the film, but I hadn't met Tim, and I still haven't met him. We had a long Zoom call. You guys look so much alike. Your mannerisms are so much alike, and I really feel like a lot of that spirit, that ability to fill the room, the dreaming, the excitement. I feel that in you. It's a very strange sensation, actually, to like have met the two of you and seen the film. But it's just like this really unusual thing.
The two moments I had with people like that in my life was really, really funny. One is I worked with Donna Summer on her last album.
Oh, I didn't even know that, really?
Yeah. Wow. And I wrote a song with her called The Queen Is Back, which actually opens her musical.
Uh-huh.
It was on her last album and then it opens her musical that they made. She was just like staring at me during the session. And I was like, what? And she was like, I feel like your father's here. Like she was like tripping out. Like,
wow.
Because she felt like she was in the room with my dad,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was so interesting. And one time I went to go to Doc McGee's office to pick up tickets to a Kiss concert.
Mm-hmm.
And some guy was sitting in the waiting room and he was just staring at me. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, I feel like I'm having an acid trip. You look just like your dad. Wow. Like this guy like freaked out. But yeah, I mean, it's weird. You know what the weirdest part about that is like the fact that I didn't grow up with him.
Right.
I didn't learn this from his mannerisms.
Mm-hmm.
But again, not a lot of not a, Tim, not though, a lot yeah. of video. Not really.
No.
You know, after my dad passed away, you know, we have different moms,
yeah,
right? As you've seen in the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm the son of Joyce, the only son of Neil and Joyce, and my brother and Tim and my other brother Brad and my older sister Jill were from my dad and Beth.
Okay.
And so after my dad passed away, growing up, you know, they lived with Beth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, they went back and forth. Like I would see them in the summer. I'd see them at different times. And I obviously loved hanging out with my older brothers and I have amazing memories of that. But I didn't get them. I didn't get them in the sense that like I was in the same household with them in a way that I ever really remembered. Like mm-hmm. there's home video of us in the front yard playing when my dad was alive, right? I mean, 3 years old, 4 years old, and we're all together playing, all four of us and this and that. But my memories of being a kid are largely just me and my mom and me and my mom, my stepdad, and then my stepsister. Like, and I would see Tim and Brad and Jill, and we were close, but they were, you know, they lived in Boston. And then Tim went to NYU. My brother Brad was in school in New Hampshire, and my sister Jill was I saw her a lot because she went to USC. So it was like, but it wasn't like this. It wasn't like I grew up in the same household as them. And they're also a lot, not a lot older than me, but like, you know, my
significantly,
yeah. My brother Tim's like 7 years older than me. My brother Brad's, I think, 5 years older than me.
I think that's a testament to the force of Neil Bogart's will right there.
For sure.
Yeah.
But that's weird, right? Like, we have a lot of the same mannerisms and a lot of the same, I mean, it's hard to argue that's not genetic.
Right. No, it completely is. And, you know, I mean, I'm yet another person who's seen it. So, yeah. You just finished another movie, or finished shooting it, right? Or almost finished shooting
They're finishing shooting it as we speak.
Okay, yeah. In the north of Italy, which is just lovely in the winter.
Oh, my God.
And tell us what it is. It is called Verona. Take it from there.
It's Verona. It is in it's an original pop musical, a feature film. It is a somewhat retelling of Romeo and Juliet with its own kind of spin to it. I think my brother said it best. It's like where Shakespeare's story left off. We kind of pick up, but also retell it in a way that we feel like was also more, historically accurate to some extent. You know, my brother's studied this for a long time and all the different, poems and writings that came before Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet, that Romeo and Juliet was based on. And it really trails down to really based on to the history in the early 1300s in Verona.
Evan, such a pleasure as always. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
Oh, thank you for having me, man. It's always great talking to you.
You've been listening to Strictly Business with Evan Bogart. Check in next week.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.